The World Tomorrow. Radio and television commentator Garner Ted Armstrong returns from a fact-finding tour in Europe.
Europe may be vital to the United States, but most Americans seem utterly oblivious to that fact. But ignoring Europe has not made it any less a vital power center.
And now, new insight into American commitments overseas. NATO, who needs it?
Why should Americans be interested in Europe? Most of us couldn't care less. Europe is a vacation land. We think of the excitement of Paris, the nightlife of London, beautiful little Swiss chalets, a trip up the Rhine, perhaps. But for many, many years on the World Tomorrow program on radio, I've been telling millions of Americans a time would come when we would see Vietnam and our concern there, the very deepest part of our involvement, paled into insignificance alongside our concern over what will be taking place inside Central Europe. For many, many years, we have talked of an impending United States of Europe. Could it be that NATO, instead of being an alliance which presupposes a line drawn between the Warsaw Pact nations, the puppets of Moscow, and the United States and the Western Alliance, a standoff inside Europe, is not only archaic and out of date, but is in fact something else? Perhaps a military umbrella under which a gigantic, gargantuan Frankenstein monster is building inside Central Europe. It's a question I've had to ponder time and time again, because, you know, it hasn't been very long since you and I were watching on our television sets the helicopter evacuation of the United States Embassy in Vietnam. We were looking at ourselves trying to bail ourselves out of the quagmire of Vietnam, and we experienced after that time a tremendous aftermath, a shock of surprise, and of course a tremendous lack of confidence on the part of many of our European allies. Many of them had to look at a very stark reappraisal of American and European relations, wondering if we finally had abandoned friends we said we would go all the way to the wall to protect, would we also do this in other parts of the world? Well, it wasn't long after that that President Ford found himself on the way to Europe to tell our European partners of the Atlantic Alliance that we would remain part and parcel of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So NATO is still special in the eyes of at least some of the policy planners in Washington, if for all that most American citizens seemingly couldn't care less about what goes on in Europe economically, politically, or militarily. Well, they do think of Europe as a playground, a vacation spa, a resort, a virtual paradise for travel, for photos, if no longer for shopping. But politically, wondering about Europe's impending military strength or becoming a full-scale third nuclear power bloc in the world, well, I have found over the last couple of decades that most Americans just simply couldn't care less. Well, let's take a look at NATO today and ask whether it will survive. Who needs it? Is it viable? NATO's problems are numerous, perhaps more so than before in its entire 25 or 6-year history. The divisive Cyprus issue that put Greece and Turkey at each other's throats, that nearly brought about war between those two members of NATO on the soft underbelly of Europe, as it's been called, in the extreme eastern flank of NATO, right closest to the Middle East. Then there was the political unrest in Portugal and the unstable Middle East to go along with it. We thought for a time there that U.S. bases out of the Azores would be threatened as a result of political upheavals that brought about virtual civil war inside of Portugal. The most serious, then, of NATO's recent problems strikes at the very heart of the alliance. But the setback in Vietnam sent shockwaves all the way to Europe. Our commitment in South Vietnam and Southeast Asia had been unwise from the beginning, that our allies had had to take note that America had not been willing to live up, finally, when the chips were down, to that ultimate commitment. Since NATO's ultimate defense lies in the American nuclear umbrella, there's always been a certain burden of proof laid upon the United States we have had to demonstrate time and again, economically primarily, because we share most of the costs, troop strength, and other ways in which America is committed. We have had to demonstrate that that umbrella is still firmly in place. Never in NATO's history, then, had that alliance been so sorely tried as immediately following our pullout of Vietnam. It was a need so strong that it sent President Ford traveling to Europe, and along with members of the international press, I was at the Brussels airport when he arrived for the NATO summit meeting. Mr. Ford hoped to convince Western Europe that nothing of the North Atlantic Alliance had changed.
It is fitting that the purpose of my first trip, Your Majesty, to Europe, as President of the United States is to participate in a NATO summit. I want my NATO colleagues and the people of Europe to know that our great alliance remains very strong.
Europe may be vital to the United States, but most Americans seem utterly oblivious to that fact. In the last decade or so, we have been able to enjoy the luxury of virtually forgetting Europe, at least so far as the power of politics of the entire geopolitical structure of the world is concerned. Our president has been able to visit Peking, Moscow. We've been able to reassure some of the Arab states to be embroiled in shuttle diplomacy in the Middle East. But Europe has pretty much been in the backwash of the thoughts of most Americans. We have asked our European allies to be dutiful allies, faithful, friendly toward the United States, willing, of course, at all times to help share the burdens and the load. But Europe has been pretty much ignored for quite a period of time. And for the most part, European nations have gone along, or so it would seem. That has left the United States free to bicker and squabble with other nations that weren't quite so compliant. We fought for years in Southeast Asia. We struggled for years in the Middle East. We put great emphasis on detente. And President Nixon, and then after him President Ford, have had time to visit not only abroad but about the United States and even turn their attention to upcoming elections. Meanwhile, Europe has all but been forgotten. But ignoring Europe has not made it any less a vital power center. It has not meant any less that virtually a quarter of all of humanity are under the spreading wings of a gigantic trading combine which is becoming, in fact, the greatest economic power the world has ever seen. It does not mean, simply because we ignore Europe on a day-to-day basis, that Europe will not eventually be the most important single concern to you in your daily newspapers as you look at embroilments, at chaos, at developments, at the threat of war, of additional nations joining the nuclear club, and ultimately as you look at European military reaction to some of the problems of the Middle East. Culturally, economically, and politically, America is obviously and admittedly the daughter of Europe. For over 200 years, there has been a very special relationship between the two continents, a relationship which has had a great impact, as you know, on the course of history. At times, we in the United States have tended toward isolationism, but we have not been able to ignore Europe for very long.
We're speaking with Dr. Francis O. Wilcox, director of the Atlantic Council. Mr. Wilcox, back in 1949, you were chief of staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Would you mind reminiscing with us right now on the inception, founding of NATO, and the subsequent development of it?
I certainly recall very much the conditions that existed in Europe that brought about the need for NATO. I went to Europe in 1948, and you could feel the insecurity that existed there. The people in Holland and in France and in various parts of Europe were very apprehensive about the possibility of a Soviet attack. And I think it was absolutely essential that the United States indicate, through something like the North Atlantic Treaty, its willingness to stand together with the other countries of Western Europe and Canada in order to deter the possibility of Soviet attack upon the West.
At that time, there was more of an overt threat. Today, with détente, the Soviets present not so much an overt threat, but maybe a covert threat. Is this a danger as far as lulling the West to sleep?
Well, at that time there was a rather recognizable threat. And I think through the years, through the 1950s, and certainly many the years in the 60s, all the administration in this country had to do to get support for a foreign policy program was to point out that it would help protect the United States and the West against the possibility of communist aggression or communist subversion. But now, with détente, as you suggest, things are somewhat different. I think the threat is still there. The communists have not given up their desire to dominate the rest of the world. But the threat is perhaps more hidden. It's a more subtle kind of threat. But unless we keep in mind the nature of the opposition, we could make some foolish moves that could weaken our position and invite really serious difficulty in the world.
When European power struggles erupted into World War I, the United States was only reluctantly drawn out of isolationism. But once the war was over, America beat a hasty retreat behind the Atlantic, refusing to join the League of Nations. But the situation after World War II was different. The stark irony was that a war which had been successful in destroying one form of totalitarianism had simultaneously succeeded in fostering another. In 1940, before entering the war against Germany, Stalin had pushed back the Finnish border by 100 miles, annexed Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and divided Poland with Hitler. Shortly thereafter, Russia entered the war against Nazism, and in 1945 met the Western Allies at the Elbe River in the final crushing of Germany. At the Yalta Conference early in 1945, Stalin had promised to allow free elections in these occupied nations. It was a promise Uncle Joe never intended to keep. The communist shroud descended over Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Albania. Western Europe, lying in ruins, war-torn and prostrate, found a budding communist superstate waiting hungrily on its eastern doorstep. In 1948, the first of the aid under the famous Marshall Plan began flowing into Europe. Over 4 years of the Marshall Plan, some $12 billion U.S. dollars were pumped into Europe, funds used to restore industrial and agricultural production, reestablish financial security, and to expand trade. Meanwhile, the Soviets were trying to gain control of West Berlin by blockading all access to the Allied sector of the city buried 110 miles deep inside the Soviet-ruled East German zone. For 11 months, Allied airlift successfully combated the Soviet stranglehold by providing every ounce of food and fuel to the cold and hungry people of West Berlin. In 1949, in response to the threat of Soviet aggression, the United States, Canada, and their Western European allies formed the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Over the next few years, NATO grew into a 15-nation bloc. In addition to Canada and the United States, NATO encompassed Belgium, Denmark, France, Greece, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Turkey, United Kingdom, and West Germany. Looking back on those hectic years, it's clear that without NATO, the Marshall Plan could not have been the success it was. Without NATO, Western Europe could not have staged its post-war economic miracle. It could not have grown into what it is today, an economic giant that actually outproduces the Soviet Union and rivals the United States.
While people struggled through the Depression, the Plain Truth magazine was warning about European nationalism. When everyone sighed relief at the end of World War II, the Plain Truth was predicting the Middle East crisis. When Korea dominated the headlines, the Plain Truth was forecasting the formation of the common market. When the space race captured America's fancy, the Plain Truth was covering trade war and the rise of Japan, future super giant. The Plain Truth magazine examines everything from world events to family life in the light of Bible prophecy, history written in advance. To keep ahead of today's world trends, request your free subscription to The Plain Truth magazine. After 40 years, still ahead of its time. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Well, is an alliance such as NATO, in the context of today's world, of the space age, of nuclear reactors, of nuclear weapons and the superpowers, really still needed? NATO, after all, is seemingly an artifact of the post-World War II Cold War era. Its original job was to provide a shield under which Europe could recover economically, and that job has been done. Is there anything, then, left for NATO to do, especially in this age of détente? We live in a far different world in those post-World War II days when it appeared that communism seemed ready to swallow up all of Europe, and it seemed urgent that NATO must be born. But in the last 10 years, there has not been any direct face-off between the Soviet Union and the United States and the Western Alliance, nowhere near as serious as that of the Berlin blockade or the Cuban Missile Crisis or the like. The Red Threat just doesn't seem to arouse the fear in American hearts that it once did. You ask yourself, when will we be treated, for example, to another spectacle like the witch hunt for communists behind every bush as we did in the McCarthy era? Well, I imagine never. Instead, we seem to be wanting to do business with the Soviet Union. We're selling wheat and corn to feed Russian people and Russian cattle, even though Russian people aren't told about it. The official press inside the Soviet Union doesn't even inform the people of the 25% shortfall of Soviet grain, and so the Soviets in turn are selling us oil to feed American cars. In fact, we're told the Cold War is over.
and has been replaced by a new era of bridge building called detente. In view of all of this, is there really any need for NATO? Does America really need to have 320,000 troops and 7,000 nuclear-tipped warheads to guard against a communist bloc that now seems to want to talk business, not war? The real question is whether detente, by putting East and West on speaking terms, can guarantee the security of Europe, as well as NATO's planes and tanks seem to do.
Mr. Wilcox, as director of the Atlantic Council, is it your opinion that detente is in the national interest of the United States?
Oh, yes. There's a lot of misunderstanding about this term detente, but I think if by that you mean a growing spirit of cooperation between the East and the West, I agree that this is desirable. It would be helpful in our national interest and in the national interests of the Soviet Union. But we have to keep in mind, with respect to detente, that they will do what they consider helpful to them, what is in their national interest, and we should cooperate in a way that is helpful to our national interest. It would be unfortunate if we were to assume that we're entering into a new period of euphoria where everything is sweet and lovely and the Russians are going to give in on a lot of important points. This just isn't so. We have to take a hard position on this question, making concessions where it is in the mutual interest of both sides to make these concessions and where it is in our national interest to do so. Soviet Union, I am sure, wants to improve its productive capacity, to strengthen its ability to produce consumer goods. It wants the technology of the West. And in some of these instances, in some ways, we can make our technology available for mutually beneficial results. But at the same time, we ought not to be hoodwinked. We ought to be very careful about the steps we take in accomplishing this very important objective of detente between the East and the West.
The Soviets have simplistically hinted at the fact that if NATO were to be dismantled, that peace would break out in Europe.
Yes, that's a very attractive proposition. You know, to dismantle the Warsaw Pact on the one hand and dismantle NATO on the other and do away with these military alliances and perhaps set up a European collective security system. There are several problems with this. One is the simple fact that if American troops were withdrawn from the continent of Europe, we would be withdrawing 3,500 or 4,000 miles. The Soviet Union would be withdrawing a very short distance indeed behind the borders of Eastern Europe. Now, if difficulties arose, they could resume their positions in a relatively short time. But the United States would be faced with the whole problem of transport and of the political questions involved in moving troops back into Europe once they had been withdrawn. How do you convince Congress, for example, that we should go back to Europe once we have decided to withdraw? So I think this is a very dangerous proposition.
So most of them have felt, leaders, seers, sages, political advisors, perhaps university professors who end up being presidential counselors, that we still need NATO. The idea seems to be a conditioned response. If we in the Soviet Union can somehow maintain a type of a parity in strategic weapons, we also need a kind of a parity in the limited tactical nuclear weapons and also in conventional forces. The thinking seeming then to be that even though we might have a slight superiority in tactical weapons and they in strategic or vice versa, we're now letting them catch up in MIRVs while we had deployed a hideously expensive ABM system and the last one is now being dismantled. But we weren't willing to allow Soviet strength to build up in a conventional sense along the Warsaw Pact borders without a conditioned response on our own part. NATO has to remain intact. But today, as never before, the cohesiveness of NATO is in grave question, whether or not the United States gives it its full support. A recent flare-up over Cyprus between Greece and Turkey, both members of NATO, created serious problems for the entire alliance. Athens charged that American policy was pro-Turkish, and that the United States had failed to deter the Turkish invasion. The Greek government announced that it would withdraw from the military aspects of NATO. That leaves in question the fate of several key U.S. bases in Greece. The United States Congress, irate over the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, banned military aid to Turkey. The Turks retaliated by threatening to close strategic U.S. bases on their mainland. The bases have been providing information on Russian military activities that was vital to NATO planning. On the western end of the Mediterranean, NATO's problems are, if anything, worse. The unstable state of affairs in Portugal raises doubts about the future NATO use of the Azores naval stations. In fact, all the trouble for NATO in the Mediterranean comes at a most inopportune time. For detente or no detente, the Soviet presence in the Mediterranean is increasing. The Russian Navy is acquiring a greater ability to react strongly to any crisis that may develop in the very critical region that lies between Europe and the Middle East. Still another very critical and economically related problem revolves around oil, a source of serious division in NATO. The 1956 Middle Eastern War nearly shattered the good faith among major members of the alliance. It was at that time that Egypt nationalized the Suez Canal, whose primary owners were Britain and France. The United States intervened diplomatically on the side of Egypt, to the great dismay of the British and French, who seriously wondered how trustworthy the United States really was. Europe and America were divided again in the 1973 Middle East War. At that time, European nations, conscious of their acute dependence on Arab oil, would not allow American planes en route to Israel to refuel at European airfields. The Middle East, with its ability to put America and Europe at odds with each other, could prove disastrous to NATO. NATO has been torn, twisted, and pulled by various alliances, allegiances, by internal and external problems and strife. It's a wonder it's been able to survive, frankly, and yet it has, because, simply, Europe and America still need each other. The United States, for its part, has recently come to realize just how scarce in this world fairly stable democracies are. As a matter of fact, in this age of chaos in government, we have seen one country after another that seemed to be democratic going the way of despotism, of anarchy. Witness what had happened in India and elsewhere, especially in Africa and some of the third world countries. So for that reason, leadership in the United States has tended to view NATO in a very special light as America's alliance with its principal partners in the democratic experiment. As for Europe, it has even more reason to want to see NATO survive. Europeans have long dreamed of a united Europe, of a European state that could be first rate, even in a superpower world. Ever since World War II, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the North Atlantic Community has been an unbalanced one, tilting toward the United States, dominated by the United States, basically supported, underwritten, and financed by the United States. The European allies would prefer to see the North Atlantic Community turn into an equal partnership. But if Europe is ever to be the equal partner of the United States militarily, as well as economically and politically, then Europe, as European leaders know, must be united. The Europeans know that their continent has the potential to emerge as a power bloc unsurpassed, unparalleled, and as a united Europe, they know fully that it could be the equal of the United States. They also know that Europe has only a very slim chance of pulling itself together unless NATO remains in place to guard not necessarily just the eastern borders, not necessarily just to offset the Warsaw Pact armies, but to guard the process of the emergence of such a third power bloc. Europe is not yet in a position to defend itself without the American nuclear umbrella, but Europe is not yet the power bloc that it one day hopes to be. When I have talked to leaders in Europe, I think one of the first ones I heard talk about being a political dwarf, yet an economic giant, was Franz Josef Strauss, who was head of the Christian Socialist Union of Bavaria and an oft-tooted possible candidate for Chancellor of West Germany. But you know, time and again, other European leaders have said the same thing. And to them it makes no sense, for example, in the vital interests of the entirety of the community and the world as a whole, when you're talking about the Middle East, the periphery of Southeast Asia, the energy question, especially Arab oil, as to why Europe cannot have the same voice in international political and economic affairs that it does within the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Since World War II, we know we have been living in the age of superpowers, an age in which the old configuration of one divided country after another inside Europe with its old hostilities and tensions is simply intolerable. It could not occur that way. Europe has known that it could never regain the political influence it once enjoyed in the rest of the world unless it were united. It could never do so divided.
And yet today, three decades after the Second World War, it is still primarily through arrangements like NATO that Europe has managed to find any degree of political cohesiveness. There are other organizations, the European Coal and Steel Community, Euratom. There is a European Parliament that I have visited and interviewed one of the leaders of that organization. And yet there is no one organization that is any more viable than that called NATO, under which and perhaps behind which a third world power bloc could emerge. It is a situation, however, this being a political dwarf and having very little voice in the really big things that matter in the world, yet being an economic giant that is felt very acutely inside Western Europe by major West European leaders. This was conveyed to me by the Prime Minister of Belgium when I attended the NATO summit. Mr. Tinnemans, in your opening remarks at the NATO summit conference, you mentioned the need for creating a climate in which we can tackle and overcome the main problems confronting humanity together. And you stressed the need for a united Europe. Has there been any substantial progress in this direction?
Well, let me say that we are still working in Europe on the basis of the Treaty of Rome and the Treaty of Paris for the Coal and Steel Authority. You know that we have now conferences at the summit baptized European Union. And at one of these summits in the month of December 74, I was charged with making a report on the future of Europe. What does it mean to make a European Union? You know, in the 50s, European political leaders were always speaking of community, a community, an economic community, a political community. In the 60s, it was a political union. Now it's a European Union. What is it exactly? What does it mean? I have to make a report to define the European Union. But for the moment, I think with the economic difficulties, the crisis and so on, the energy crisis, I think Europe is not in a good shape. We don't know exactly for the moment what we want. So there is a need for more thinking and for a discussion about the future of Europe. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's mentioned, and you read just a few phrases in order to draw attention upon these aspects.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tinnemans. We appreciate so much your taking time out to visit with us in your very hectic schedule at the NATO Summit Conference here in Brussels. Thank you, sir. But you know, Europeans want the same things we do when it all comes right down to it. They want their place in the world. They want their day in the sun. They want their peace of mind. They want protection. They want guarantees of secure borders. They want the ability to go about their daily way of life unfettered by fear and worry of being virtually obliterated or being made the slave states of the would-be masters of the world, the Soviet Union. If you want the true overview of what is going to happen inside Central Europe, you need to get your name on the mailing list of The Plain Truth. You can have it. All you need to do is to address your letter to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Remember, there is no charge for The Plain Truth, for any book that you write for any literature I announce, no request for money. It is absolutely free to you if you write to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, brought to you by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your request along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales.